June. Hug.
Hi, my name is June. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you so much, all of you who had anything to do with letting me be a part of this. I really admire the two guys that I get to be sharing with today. And there's a lot of people in this room that are really important to me, and I'm looking forward to meeting more of you, you know, during the course of the day. I'm really nervous, and you know, my buddy Cliff Roach used to say, if you're nervous, it's kind of good because it means you care. And I do care. I care very much about Alcoholics Anonymous. I care very much about the program that we have laid out in this book, and the service that has added so much, you know, to my life. And I really want to thank Roger, there he is back there, for having this idea and all the people that helped support it. Part of the reason I'm nervous is that, quite honestly, I do not believe that this is one of my strengths. Seriously, I don't know that many people in this room, but I can name several of you who I honestly believe could do a better job of telling you about steps 1, 2, and 3 than I will do. One time, Mike Lean and I were at a conference together, and I was talking, and I said something along the lines of, well, I want to tell you 3 of the most important things that I've learned in sobriety. And I went on and I said, in number 1, and I won't tell you what they were because you don't really care. But anyway, I said number 1, and then I said in number 2, and you know, and I went on and I was talking, and about 5 minutes later, a woman in the back raised her hand, and I said, yes. And at this point, you know, I was in a completely different subject, and she said, what was number 3? So the idea of keeping me on a topic for an extended period of time, I'm very much like the dog in a Disney film, you know, like squirrel. And so that's going to happen here no matter how hard I try. I did make some notes, which I normally do not do when I'm talking, unless I'm talking about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous or the traditions or a concept or something. But I felt that I really wanted to try as best I could to stay in here. I thought, too, when Joe was telling the story about the fact that this facility let us have the room today, I thought about how fortunate are we that the former members of Alcoholics Anonymous who used to meet here acted in such a way that they would want to let us come back. Which then made me think about the doctor's opinion where, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but where he says, you can rely on what these people tell you. And it made me really just feel happy to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because sadly, in the years that I have been sober, I have sometimes seen people forget about the importance of how they act and what they do and how it might affect someone else coming to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of meetings I know that don't exist anymore. Because people thought that their right to do certain things that were asked not to do was more important than thinking about keeping a room open for someone who might need to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I also thought of this other story, which has nothing to do with steps 1, 2, or 3, which will frequently happen this morning. Oh, God, I didn't set the timer. Okay, let me do that. And, okay, timer. Okay, sorry. There we go. But, you know, the idea, thank you. You know, the idea of Roger having this idea and talking to some other people and, you know, then making this come together, it just made me think of a good friend of mine, a guy named Don Locke. And Don had 3 years more than I do. My sobriety date is July the 13th, 1972. And that means, in case you're not good at math, which I'm still not really, but that's 51 continuous years of sobriety, a day at a time. And when I was 3 years sober in 1975, Alcoholics Anonymous was having an international convention celebrating the 40th year of Alcoholics Anonymous existing in Denver, Colorado. So this guy, Don Locke, who I probably knew a tiny bit because he was kind of from our area, but he was sober, as I said, 3 years ahead of me. When he was about a year sober, he heard about this international convention that was coming up. We were in Southern California, and Denver, it's not that far. You know, it's drivable. It wouldn't be like if it was New Jersey where none of the AA cars could have made it. In the first 5 years, people were sober. So Don thought, you know, it's not that far. He said, what I want to do is let's try and do something where we can get 40 people to go to the 40th anniversary for $40 so that we could really make it affordable. And what Don did was he looked ahead and, you know, I don't know how he did it back in the day, but, you know, he figured out a place to have tents so that they could camp out, which would make it much less expensive. And he reserved a tent site. And then, you know, different people in AA brought some, you know, tents, and people who weren't even going gave some sleeping bags. And, you know, he did all of that. And he kept this to about $40. Now, they were meeting at midnight at a place called the Radford Club, where we had a lot of meetings out in the valley. And they're meeting at midnight because it was about a 16-hour drive, and it was desert. It was in July. And again, a lot of the AA cars wouldn't have made it in the daytime. So they're leaving at midnight, and they're meeting at Radford. And when they get there, you know, different people are coming, and as they show up, they're going, all right, you know, you six get in that van with Jimmy, and, you know, you three get in the Corolla with Joe, and, you know, you four, you know, get in the car with Michaeline. And, you know, they were just passing out cars, and now they're still kind of running near the end, and everybody, they're getting ready to leave, and this drunk guy came, because Radford would frequently have midnight meetings. So this drunk guy comes up, and he's like, where are you going? And they go, well, you know, we're going to a convention. He goes, I want to go to a convention. So they threw him in the back of one of the cars, and they drove off to Utah for their first stop. And they stopped in a town called Beaver, Utah. And they rented, you know, lots of those, you know, that tent site. And so they got there in the morning. Everybody's pretty tired, but they set up their camps, and they set it up, and it was kind of hot. And everybody probably took a nap and got something to eat. And then they went to the local meeting in Beaver. Now, at the local meeting, there was that one guy that we sometimes hear about in smaller towns. And he was there, and he had a small pot of coffee, and he had a big book, and he was waiting to see if anybody was going to come that night. And in came 41, because we got the guy who is awake now for his first sober meeting. And they went in, and they had a meeting. And the guy in Beaver, he said, promise me that you guys will come back. I mean, we've never had anything like this in Beaver, Utah. I've never been to a meeting with 40 people. He goes, promise me you guys will come back. And so Don said, you know, we will. And Don started the Beaver campout that's still going. It's my understanding it's still going. They moved it to Labor Day weekend. And they'd go back, of course, every year and see this guy and have this roundup and other meetings and stuff. And by the way, they only celebrate, unless they've changed that tradition, I've been to it, but they only celebrate 1 year's, just 1 year birthdays. And that first year that they were there, the drunk guy who got in the back of the van took his 1 year, and he's still sober today. And so sort of like, you know, what Pam was saying about how, you know, an idea, you know, don't be afraid if you've got a new idea to do something, you know, fun in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it can be a wonderful way to be of service. I also thought, you know, we were talking on the drive here yesterday, we were listening to Sybil for a little while, and we listened to a buddy, Howard P., and, you know, we were just telling some different stories, and remembering that when Bill Wilson first got sober, and in case you don't know, because someone told me like not that long ago, they were out to coffee, and at the coffee shop, one of the guys said, who's this Bill Wilson guy that you guys talk about? Because we sometimes forget, you know, we're four generations in to the existence of Alcoholics Anonymous. And unless we're sharing about who our founders were or how this started, there wouldn't be any reason that someone brand new might know that. So anyway, Bill Wilson was one of our co-founders. He had 6 months sober when he started to work with Dr. Bob, who's our co-founder. And I love the fact, and I didn't point this out, but someone else did, but you know, about the fact that we celebrate the anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous, with some controversy sometimes about the exact date. But anyway, we celebrate it as the time that Bill and Bob both got sober, not the date that Bill Wilson got sober. But anyway, so here's Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson has 6 months. Now, there is not an alcoholic in this room or any other room that doesn't know how long 6 months is. It's unbelievable. 6 months. Now, Bill having 6 months, they didn't know, you know, what was working. I mean, remember, when Bill had 6 months and he met Dr. Bob, we didn't have a book. We didn't have steps. We didn't have traditions. We didn't have general service office. We had one guy talking to another guy. And they were trying to figure out what it, Bill Wilson had 6 months. Now, Bill also had ulcers and an extremely nervous stomach. And so he frequently drank sauerkraut and tomato juice to kind of calm his stomach down. And in those early days of AA, they gave that sauerkraut and tomato juice to the new members because they didn't know if that was what was helping Bill stay sober. And so, you know, on our drive up, we were saying how grateful we are. There's a book and steps, and we don't have to drink tomato juice and sauerkraut. So, all right, I want to look and see what a couple of my notes. One of my favorite lines in all our literature, and by the way, I guarantee you, the next time you hear me talk, I'll say that, and it'll be something completely different. So I just, but this one has been, you know, one of my favorites for quite a while. And it's in the foreword to the 12 and 12. And it says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And for me, it's super important that happily is in there. I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous happy. I was, you know, I sometimes when I'm sharing, I talk about the fact that, you know, I was a huge fun sucker when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I could walk into a room that was really happy and I could bring the whole energy down. I could just share just a couple of stories about my tragic past and all the things that had been done to me and how hopeless it all was. And, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with as many related disorders as, you know, probably anybody else. I didn't have any place to live. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any family. I didn't have anybody that would have accepted a collect phone call from me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a seventh grade education. I had a rotten attitude. I was facing court cases. I was illegally in the country. You know, there were things that were going on. And, you know, these old timers were saying things like, just don't drink. It's like, you know, I mean, I have real problems. And, you know, like Sandy Beach used to say, like, which one's the money step? You know, where, and they got all this stuff, there should be more direct directions on, you know, where's the money step? So, you know, I was not happy, joyous, and free for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And very grateful, you know, that I didn't drink no matter what. I did not believe Alcoholics Anonymous could work for somebody like me. I really believed I was more broken than anybody else. I had so much self-pity. And again, when I was reading and, you know, so I was reading some stuff last night and yesterday, you know, it was saying that, you know, that's for me, self-pity, I inflicted it on others, and it was a huge character defect of mine, you know, that I would do that. But of course, you know, in the early years of my sobriety, I didn't know that. And there was a guy who talked at one of my original home groups at the Brentwood meeting one time, and I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated everything about myself. I had always, as far as I could remember, hated everything about myself. I never liked how I looked. I never liked where I lived. I never liked anything that was happening in my life. And most of all, you know, I never liked how I felt. Never, never, never. And that's why somebody like me needed alcohol and what it did for me. Because it helped me not feel. It helped me not care. And I was an over-carer, you know. I suffered from a crippling sensitivity that, you know, our literature talks about, and I suffered from it even after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, everything didn't immediately get better for me after I took a 30-day chip. And so if you have been sober a while and you are struggling, I want to encourage you to stay close to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, to not drink no matter what, and to hopefully your pain will lead you to be willing to ask someone else, you know, for them to share their experience, strength, and hope in whatever area it is, you know, that might be helpful. I think that so often I was so busy beating myself up, you know, that I didn't have time to even listen to the speakers, you know, a lot of the time. So this guy at Brentwood, what he was saying one time, and I'd been sober maybe 20 years at this point, I don't know, a long time, I considered that a long time. And he said, you know, an egomaniac is not necessarily someone who thinks well of themselves. And I thought, well, that's weird. Because if you'd said to me, what's the definition of an egomaniac? I'd think, well, it's someone who thinks they're the best looking, they're the smartest, you know, they're all that. And the speaker said, no, it's not necessarily someone who thinks well of himself. It's not necessarily even someone who thinks often of themselves. It's simply someone who thinks only of themselves. And I thought, oh my God. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, a huge egomaniac. It was the reverse of what I would have thought, but I was constantly comparing myself, thinking about myself, me, 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 I, as Chuck C. used to talk about. And so, you know, for me, getting active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and staying active in Alcoholics Anonymous in a variety of different types of service has been so important that I can't even put it into words, because it was what I believe helped me with that psychic transformation that every alcoholic needs to have if they're going to continue to stay sober, I believe. And some people refer to that as their spiritual experience, their spiritual awakening, their psychic transfer. I mean, I don't think it matters, but that change. And so for me, a lot of that was what would help me start to think about someone else instead of always just thinking about me. And what can I get, making that transformation to what can I give, what can I add to the meeting, what can I add to my family, what can I add at work? And that's not the way I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I found that those tools, through the application of the steps, became and have become the foundation, you know, of what I'm trying, you know, to shoot for. So I want to see if I made any other good notes here. I haven't talked about a single one yet, so who knows? Well, I thought too when I was reading last night, you know, in the doctor's opinion where it talks about, you know, that we are doomed. I mean, there really is no good spin that you can put on doomed. You know, you can't like, it doesn't say a little doomed or kind of doomed. I mean, like doomed, you know, so this is really serious. And I'm going to try and say this when I talk again later, because I wrote it down twice on my notes, because I think it's so important. I think it's so important that we make sure that we have a sponsor or a guide, and that we're running, that we're talking about what's going on or what we're thinking or what's going on with us. Because that difference in perspective can be huge. You know, Sandy, again, he used to talk about, you know, the thing about having a relationship with your sponsor is you can call them up and you can tell them about something that's going on, and maybe it's a difficulty, it's a challenge, it's a problem, and you're telling them, and you tell them all about it. And at the end of that, they share something with you, and you say, well, it's not that bad if you want to look at it that way, you know. And that's something that I think is just so important and, you know, so valuable. And one of the things that I think can be so dangerous for us, you know, in sobriety is to have secrets. So it's been really important for me. I have no secrets. That doesn't mean I tell everybody every thought that I've ever had. I don't want to scare everybody. You know, but I make sure that I don't have anything that's going around in my brain, which is usually something that's going to separate me from you and make me feel, again, less than, or I'm not doing it right. And, you know, and by the way, I think so often, you know, Mark and I, we went to a workshop, you know, about the Big Book, and at one point, and, you know, we came out of there, and we both had, you know, he had 30 years sober, and I guess I had like 45 years sober, and we came out, and then we thought, I don't think we've done it right. You know, we have a, I mean, we have a really good life. I'm really grateful. And yet, you know what I mean? When you're like, it's like, wow, you know. And I think that that's, it's a nice thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, one of our early members, a guy named Alan McGinnis, who wrote the pamphlet, it was his talk, he didn't write it, but it was his talk that he gave to a bunch of professionals about addiction and alcoholism at UCLA. And, you know, Alan McGinnis would talk at that Brentwood group. He helped start it. And he would start by saying, anything I say today is going to be my opinion. And he said, I guarantee you that there's someone in every row in the meeting that would have a different opinion. And yet, you know, as long as we're trying to apply these principles and do the best we can and we don't drink, we can all stay sober having some of these different opinions. And he said, and one thing that's so great in Alcoholics Anonymous is that the next time you see me, I might not even agree with my own opinion that I had the last time. And I think that's really, I credit to a large extent Bill Wilson with some of that. Because in my study of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill was flawed. He made a lot of mistakes, and I'm so grateful that, you know, he didn't get sober and get perfect, because that's kind of what I thought we were going to need to do here, and I certainly have not done that. But I have, you know, 100% perfectly not taken anything that affects me from the neck up. And if I don't drink, even when I make terrible mistakes, and I have made some, then I have an opportunity to reach out to someone to find out what I need to do different, what I need to do better. And, you know, when it comes to the powerlessness, you know, and we come into Alcoholics Anonymous and we look at that, you know, I when I got sober, Chuck Chamberlain was, you know, a very important member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He shared a lot and he had a lot of things to say that meant nothing to me then. And yet years later began to be very, very important to me. And Chuck would always talk about the fact that, you know, way back in chapter 3, it says we have to fully concede to our innermost self that we are alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. It's not step one. It's getting to that place where we know that we are bodily and mentally different, that we will not be able to drink like normal people. Again, like the doctor's opinion said, you know, I was reading it again last night, and, you know, that idea that it's, you know, the importance of abstinence. And of course, I don't want to get, you know, into a lot of opinions or whatever. But for me, sobriety means that I'm not taking anything that affects me from the neck up. And that's worked very, very well for me throughout the years. And, you know, and I know that it's worked for Joan, you know, who got sober in 1957. She's one of our first generation members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I feel really lucky that she's here today, you know. I remember too, you know, Sandy also, I just have all these, you know, these different people that float into my life. And Sandy would talk about, you know, he was talking to his sponsor and his sponsor had him like read the doctor's opinion. So he did. And then his sponsor said, well, what was that about? You know, Sandy, what did it mean to read the doctor's opinion? And he said, well, it means, you know, alcoholism is bad, you know, Sandy's sponsor said, no, it means Sandy's going to die. So it's a different, it's that perspective that we get, you know, from a sponsor, that we don't see it quite the same way all the time. All right. I love, you know, when I was rereading last night in the 12 and 12, you know, on page 26, it says, AA doesn't require you to believe anything. So when we get to starting to talk about, you know, step two, and I have had a lot of struggles throughout the years that I've been sober with, you know, what do I believe and what do I understand and what does that mean? And, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and they said, you can pick whatever you want as a higher power, I actually was scared that something bad could happen just for them saying that out loud. I I did not believe that at all. There are certain things you can't mess around with, and you guys are, you know, blasphemous, I guess, is one of the words, you know, but I mean, it's this is dangerous talk. So I believed that there was something. I was really trying to fly under the radar as much as I could, and in a lot of ways, I had a harder time saying the third step prayer than I did doing my fourth step. Because I was trying not to have a conscious contact. I was hoping he'd be busy and not really remember me. And I can remember one time I was at my home group, and the next day I was going to court, and one of my best friends in the program, I was about 9 months sober, and I said, "Well, you know, Mike, I got to go to court tomorrow, and you know, I'm really scared." And he said, "Don't worry about it, kid. I'm going to say a prayer for you." And I said, "Don't do that." And I wasn't trying to be funny. I'm like, let's not go there. That's, you know, it's just too risky. Let's just..." Okay. Yeah, I heard a woman share, and of course I can't remember exactly what she said, but just, you know, a few months ago, and she was saying that her sponsor, you know, told her to, you know, write down 10 of the most difficult, the craziest, the hardest, the most humiliating experiences that she'd had as a result of drinking. And so she made this list. And then, you know, she's saying to her sponsor, "I can't believe I did that. I really can't believe I did that." And her sponsor said, "Really, what I want you to see is that you drank again. You did this. It was so humiliating, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization in one sentence of how you described what you did. And then you drank again. And then we've got the other 9 things that we haven't even talked about. You know, and that's the insanity of alcoholism, and that's why you need help, and you need to come to believe in a power that's greater than yourself. And I love the freedom and the flexibility that we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous to find out what that is and to change it along the way and to go back to it if we want to. So many of my, the people I sponsor, many of them have gone back to their original religion. I have very dear friends in Alcoholics Anonymous who have found another religion. I have other friends that still are very comfortable being an agnostic, and yet they believe that there's a creative intelligence that wants only good in the universe, as suggested in the big book, you know, and so they're willing to be of service and they're willing to add. And what I can tell you is that I've had times of an incredible connection to a higher power. That I can't even describe how close and how safe and how wonderful it felt. And then I've lost it. And I don't know why, and I don't know what happened. And I spent a lot of time, you know, wondering about that and talking about that and writing about that and asking my sponsor about that, you know. And it's sort of, you know, that whole idea about, you know, like the house is on fire, just get out of the house. So it's kind of like asking about alcoholism. Why am I an alcoholic? Why would I be an alcoholic? I mean, my cousin did this. How come he's not an alcoholic? You know, when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous and we're so wrapped up in there, it's like, that's not the important question. It's like, what are we doing now? What are we going to do moving forward? And so, I mean, this is probably, I'm probably stealing some of the ideas from what, you know, Joe and Jimmy are going to share about later, but I just thought I'd throw mine in there, you know, about this whole idea of a higher power and, you know, trying to figure things out. I think that definitely for me, in the times where I've had my struggles or been defiant or rebellious about prayer or whatever it is, I've always been able to find that there are other powers that are greater than myself. So 100% I can go down to the ocean anytime, and I do on a regular basis, and know that that is a power greater than myself. And that provides me with tremendous comfort. I have always been able to believe that the group, that Alcoholics Anonymous as a group can do something that I alone cannot do. And so that's always been able to be a consistent power greater than myself. And then, as I said, I've had different beliefs along the way, and I've changed them, and I've become comfortable. You know, I was reading a story. I don't know if this will mean anything to you guys or not, but there was a wisdom teacher, and a lot of people had gone to meet with him because they wanted to, you know, become enlightened. And they were sitting in a room and they kept saying, how do I get enlightened? And what can I do? I want to be enlightened. And what could I, you know, what do I need to do to be enlightened? And he was kind of getting a little annoyed. And so he goes, all right, here's what we're going to do. Passed out a piece of paper to everybody and a pen, to everybody in the room. He goes, I want you right now, don't say anything, don't talk to anybody else. I want you to take that paper and I want you to look around this room and I want you to give me the exact dimensions of this entire room. And then he gave them about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and they each came up and gave him the answer. This one, he looked at each of them, and he goes, these are all wrong. The answer is, I don't know. And it's important for me to be able to get to that place where I can say, I don't know. And it's certainly important, you know, when we're new. And it's not easy. I mean, I've been sober a long time. Sometimes saying I don't know is not any easier, it feels like, you know, than it used to be. Because now I've got an ego and I've been sober over 50 years and I should know this and that and, you know, whatever. And so it's really important that I remember to be able to be teachable, that I want to continue to learn, that I'm not having the same experience in Alcoholics Anonymous 51 years later that I had in my first 5 years sober. That would actually be kind of boring, wouldn't it? Although I have to tell you that I'm not always excited, you know, when I'm given a new experience to apply all these principles. I'm like, oh, you know, I'd like to support someone else applying these principles. And one of the things, too, you know, as I have these struggles, you know, sometimes with faith, and I feel like, gosh, you know, I must have missed a step. I must not be doing it right. I mean, there's something, it just feels like everybody else is, you know, by the time they're 6 months sober, they've got it all figured out, you know. And it often felt that way throughout the years in sobriety. You know, by a year, it felt like they were out of debt. They'd become CEO of a company. I was 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before I could afford to put a dollar in the basket on anything like a regular basis. And I felt like such a huge loser in Alcoholics Anonymous because I couldn't put, you know, that dollar in the basket. I look back in hindsight and I see how fortunate I was that I was that poor. I had no life when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had no life for several years after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, which meant that for me, I had to make Alcoholics Anonymous my entire life because I didn't have any other options. I had no friends. My family did not invite me to an event until I was 5 years sober, you know. So I went to 21 meetings a week during my first 2.5 years. I got a lot of commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous because my pride hated the fact that I couldn't put money in the basket, and so I tried to overwork in my own mind more than a dollar. And I look back and I think, gosh, I've been overpaid since the very beginning when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous by doing that, because sadly, I do have the kind of an ego, I know I do, that would have thought, I'll just throw $10 in the basket and I'll walk out. I don't have to do any of these chairs and wash any of those dishes, you know. But I didn't have that. So I did a lot of chairs and I did a lot of dishes. And, you know, I made some fabulous friends in Alcoholics Anonymous and I learned so many, you know, things. And I think that those of us who stay active in service, we find out that it doesn't really matter what our attitude is. You know, my first home group, you know, not my first home group, my second home group, Brentwood, had 420 metal chairs in a room kind of like this. And one of my commitments was to slam each, they didn't say to slam, but, because they make a nice noise, those metal chairs, you know, 420. And I often did it myself. I got there early so I could just slam them away. I liked the sound, made me, you know, feel good. But it was, you know, at the end of the day, when the meeting began, there were chairs there for the guys who'd walked over from the VA to sit. And there were chairs for, you know, the speaker and whoever else had come. And, you know, the longer I'm sober, the more grateful I am, you know, for Alcoholics Anonymous, for the people who told me to keep coming back, you know, because I really, I was definitely tolerated in a number of places in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very grateful, you know. And those simple words, you know, I think a lot of times when Joan shares her story, and she went to her first meeting, and she didn't get sober that night. But someone said to her to keep coming back, and she thought it was because they liked her. She didn't know they said it to everybody, you know. But still, you know, to try and, you know, for me to try and remember that that's the kind of Alcoholics Anonymous that I want to be an active part of today. You know, I want to remember. And, you know, all of us who've been sober a while have had the experience of having our friends have their kids struggle with the disease of alcoholism, their grandkids struggle with the disease of alcoholism. So alcoholism has not gone away. And, you know, I want to be sure that I'm doing everything I can to be sure that Alcoholics Anonymous can be here for fun and for free for someone else who might need it, you know. And I think that that happens in so many different ways. And so I look back and I think, I don't know about you guys, but I am positive that in my first 5 years sober, I never went over to the guy who unlocked the door and said, "Hey, Sam, thanks for getting there 2 hours early and unlocking the door so there could be a meeting tonight." I wasn't thinking of any of that. I was thinking about, where's the money step? You know, when am I going to get it? You know, where's mine? When am I going to get, you know, something? Or when's it going to feel different? Or what about me? And so today I'm kind of a little bit more aware of that. You know, when you think about, even today when Roger was up here, you know, talking about, you know, Roger's great. We all can agree on that. But Roger didn't do this alone, you know. And there's even more help, you know, than Roger might recognize, not just Roger, but any of us, if we don't, you know, like spin it out. Like, let's spin it out to who, you know, who drove who here, you know, who helped Jimmy get to the airport, you know, who helped, you know what I mean, all of this. It just goes on and on so that each of us, you know, could be here to have some laughs, to share some stories, to share some experience, strength, and hope about the solution, you know, to a fatal disease that we're doomed to die from, and yet we don't have to, you know, and we get to laugh. I remember that was something Dr. Paul used to say, was he'd say, he'd read all these different books about diseases, but this was the only book about a fatal disease he'd ever read that had things about being happy, joyous, and free in the in the literature. You know, when we come to, you know, the third step, and when we get to that part where, you know, we're going to talk about making that decision, I think that, you know, it talks about in our literature over and over again that willingness, you know, is what it really starts out with and continues to be important throughout the years. So for me, I like to share a story that I've shared it a few different times, but it was of the utmost importance to me and continues to be. So there's the first woman to get sober west of the Mississippi was a woman named Sybil. She got sober in 1941 after reading the Jack Alexander article. I had the privilege of knowing her and her husband, Bob Corwin, and she was Joan's sponsor at one point, too. But Sybil got sober in 1941. Sybil married a man, well, she married a couple, but the the last man that Sybil married was a guy named Bob Corwin. And Bob also came to Alcoholics Anonymous pretty close to 1941, maybe a little bit later. But Bob was an atheist, and Bob struggled and was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for many years. And Bob said that one of the meetings that Sybil was a regular at was a meeting called the Hole in the Ground. And it's called that, it was called that because you, well, you know, but you had to go down like four stairs. It was kind of like in a basement thing, which we don't have very many basements in California. So that was kind of a, you know, an interesting idea. So, and there was a window next to those stairs. And Bob Corwin said that sometimes when he would come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, he wouldn't go in the room. He said, "I'm, you know, this is a place where losers go, and I'm a bigger loser than the losers who are in there because I can't even stay sober with the losers." And he would stay outside and just listen at the window. And eventually, Bob did get sober. And, you know, when Sybil died, she died with 57 continuous years of sobriety. And at that time, that was the longest So she was the longest sober person in all of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not true anymore. I don't know who that person is or how long they have, but we know it's past 57. I mean, we have Joan here with 66 and 11 months. But when Bob passed, before Bob passed away, his birthday, he turned 58 years sober. And the first thing he said to me was, I've got longer than Sybil. So anyway, so Bob went to thousands of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how you keep track of how many, but he went to a lot during those years that he was not staying sober. And then he went to these meetings in his early years of sobriety. And he said he was maybe 10 years sober. I can't remember, maybe longer. But so, you know, we're going to assume at least 1,000 times he'd heard Chapter 5. And he said he was in a meeting one night, and a young girl got up to read Chapter 5. And by the way, this is one of my little opinions. Nobody cares about it, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. I happened to be anti-chanting in the meetings. And that's, I guess, partly because they didn't chant when I got sober. And I got a whole list of reasons that none of you care about, but I just want to mention it. So Bob was at the meeting, and this young girl got up to read Chapter 5. And he wasn't really paying attention to Chapter 5 because he'd already heard it hundreds and hundreds of times. And I'm sure all of you pay close attention to every word, but some of the others of us, we drift here and there. So he was, you know, kind of drifting in and out while she was reading, and then she got to the ABCs. And she started to cry, and she started to shake. And I'm thinking almost anybody who's been in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where you've seen someone cry and shake, especially at a podium, you sort of start to kind of root for them. You know, you don't say anything out loud, but you're like, you can do it. It's, you know, you can do it. And, you know, you're just kind of rooting. So she was, A, B. I mean, she was really crying. It wasn't like the cute little, you know, movie tears or something. And then she got to C, and she said, C, God could and would if he were sought. And Bob said, maybe 20 years of going to meetings and hundreds of times hearing that, he had always heard it say, God could and would if he were found. And since he was an atheist, he wasn't going to be finding. But he thought that night, he said, maybe the closest I'll ever come will be in the seeking. And that has offered me tremendous comfort time and time again throughout my years, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I want to learn more, I want to listen to more, I want to hear more, I want to see. You know, we used to say something a lot when I was new. I don't hear it hardly ever anymore, but it was, you know, take what you can use and leave the rest. And so often, as I, you know, said earlier, these people that I heard in those early years of my sobriety, you know, when I would listen to Chuck Chamberlain talk, for example, he could easily have been speaking Latin, which I do not speak. And so I didn't know what he was saying. And then 10 or 20 years later, some of these things that he shared and some of these other old timers that used to just drone on and on, like some of the newer people here today are thinking I'm doing. So I want to encourage you to stay close to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, to not drink no matter what, and then to reach out your hand and say, I don't know, keep coming back.